So some of you know Matthew, some of you may not. I'm not going to try to give you background by way of introduction. Matthew's part of this community, and that's how I've gotten to know him, is through his coming and spending time here with us. And one of the things that I've gotten to know about Matthew over the last year and a bit, is how significant the practices that we would widely use words like meditation or mindfulness for, how important those practices are, foundational those practices are to his own spiritual life. And that's led to sort of an ongoing dialogue between us in a number of different settings about those things, which, sort of like my conversations with Adrian, have felt to me like they've opened in a really kind of tangible, understandable, accessible way something that might otherwise be a thing that I've heard about, read about, thought about, but have had relatively few personal engaging conversations with people who live in that realm more actively. And so that's been a really lovely gift in my life already, and I've so enjoyed those conversations and the friendship.
Yeah, me too.
So looking forward to this version of that. And Matthew and I have spent a little bit of time considering how do we try to open this in, 30 minutes or so in this community. And so I'm gonna refer to my notes on occasion, not because the conversation's scripted, but because we know between us that there are certain things that we do want to touch on and make sure that we kind of at least gesture toward in our conversation this morning. So by way of a starting point, how many of you caught the typo in the blurb? Just my wife, who has radar. I said, I think Tim Penner probably. Anyway, excellent. Kreen skimmed it too. In fact, her email said something like, I just skimmed it, but did you mean to say? In the last paragraph, the word mediation should be the word meditation. All right, can we all just, little grace, spell checker. Honestly, I proofed it twice. You cannot proof your own writing. It does not work. I cannot proof my own writing. It does not work, more to the point. That paragraph, the reason I point to it is because the content of it, I think, matters in this context, which is in the spiritual realm that I grew up in, the religious realm that I grew up in, anything that had the word meditation appended to it was like, beep, 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 danger, danger, danger. You're going to empty your mind, and God only knows what's going to flow in there. Right? Just some nods, yeah. Which, given the range of people groups and spiritualities and religions that have found meditation to be an important practice, I suppose if you were trying to safeguard a religion as a parent, there's kind of a logic to that. But as soon as we stand back from the fear and realize mostly it's about what we don't know rather than what we do know, we can kind of open this conversation. At least that's been my experience. So I wanted to say that kind of by way of setting this up a little bit in our context. The other thing is that you don't even have to try to encounter the fact that at this time of the year, our interior life and its exterior expressions in this climate struggle. That there's a reason, there are reasons why this is a hard time of the year. And some of those reasons are well approached through these practices in terms of our mental health as well as our physical well-being and our spiritual well-being. And so in some ways, that's why we chose this time in the calendar to have this conversation. So Matthew, by way of kind of getting us going, let's just talk a little bit about that health part of it, and in particular about the ways in which the practices of meditation or mindfulness, and you can differentiate those however you wish by way of introducing the way you're using the terms, but how those things bear really practically and directly on our well-being as people.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here. I'm glad I get this opportunity. I didn't really enter into meditation or any kind of mindfulness practices, which what I would describe as what you do when you're just sitting still and being silent. And there's all kinds of ways of approaching and relating to that. And it's fascinating, as time has gone on, there's just become more and more awareness and research into how this actually affects us in positive ways. And seemingly, especially more so, given the nature of our culture and society and the kind of constant bombardment with information and stresses and all kinds of challenges that are just difficult to know how to navigate. And that wasn't really how I approached it. It was never from this particularly secular approach. But I do find it compelling that it's not just nothing. It's not purely in some kind of metaphysical spiritual realm that's only applicable if you believe certain things. That you can really approach these as openly and as non-ideologically as possible, and there's still an impact. That's not the most compelling aspect of it for me, but it does kind of add something to the picture. That's like, oh, there's something fascinating happening when as human beings, when we just take time to be still, as we're able to, and to just not do anything, that actually improves our well-being in some significant ways. And there just continues to be more and more research of how that can improve our mood, reduce symptoms of depression, reduce anxiety, reduce stress, actually changing the brain, our brain matter, and that's pretty wild. That there's clear, you know, biological and physiological aspects to this that are like, oh, this is worth doing, you know, regardless of the context that we approach it in. But for me, that just becomes, you know, and for some people that's fine if that's all it ever is. For me, the value of it has always been much deeper than that, and that's kind of where, that's more or less where my initiation sort of began.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, sort of the personal story of what led mm-hmm. you toward this practice.
Yeah. One thing that comes to mind, I remember at some point, I grew up very heavily involved in the church and was, I think, would have been described by many people as like the ideal Christian young person, being involved, you know, with youth and anything I could. And it was incredibly meaningful for me. And I remember at one point, I'm sure I was in high school, and seeing some kind of show with Buddhist monks and kind of going over their meditation practice. And I thought to myself, well, they've totally got it wrong. That's not true at all. I don't know what they're doing, but I'm pretty sure that's not okay. And
and then
stopping for a minute, I'm like, but they seem like such nice people. I don't really understand how to reconcile that. I mean, whatever. So I just let it go. And didn't really think of it too much.
Surrounded as you were by the other message, you didn't need to reconcile it right then, did you?
Yeah,
right,
exactly. Like, oh, okay, exactly. Well. It was just like, well, they're wrong, but I guess it must make them kind of nicer, so that's not terrible, I suppose. Yeah, that's a bonus. And for me, this question, what was the quote you said again? Oh, okay, that's okay. Something about unbelief creating new forms of faith.
Making room for faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was always terrifying to me. And any sense of unbelief. I remember I did a year of Bible college after high school. And it was near the end of the year. I remember having a conversation with someone. And it was, what are you most afraid of? And I remember just this deep existential terror. And my response was, I'm afraid of losing my faith. Like, that's... And there was something weird about that, where it was like, oh, well, what does that actually mean? And there was this sense that I'm afraid that I won't believe the right things anymore, and it's the right things that are going to save me. And again, that wasn't reconciled at that point. That was just kind of a hanging bit of a question mark. And, you know, as time went on, I just began to encounter more and more limitations to my understanding of faith and what that was. And I think that's more and more common for more and more people, as we're just exposed to different ideas and perspectives, and we encounter others in relationship and are forced to confront these things in ways that, when they're at a distance, it's easier to just not deal with them or not allow the implications to really do some work within us, stirring up different questions that don't have maybe clear, obvious answers. And I remember another point, a conversation with someone over the phone, this vivid moment, we were arguing something about theology, and what it was didn't really matter, but I remember being so adamant about it, and at one point, I was just aware, like, I don't actually know why I believe this. I don't know why I think this is true, but I'm so convinced that I'm right about this.
Somebody told me, this is a hill you should die on, and here I am on the edge of it, and I don't know why I'm fighting for this.
Right? Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. So it was one of those moments where there was an opening where I began to realize, oh, maybe things aren't the way that I thought they were.
We could have, we won't, but we could have an entire, I think, fruitful conversation about the distinction between belief and faith, which often get treated in religious practice as synonyms.
Yeah.
But they're not. They're not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
We can believe many things ideologically and not trust them as well, and not have faith in them. We can believe things ideologically and have faith in them and then realize our faith is in the ideas, which means our faith is essentially in our own process and our own things that we're laying out for ourselves. So in ourselves, in the end of all of that. And so as soon as you get to that point in the dialogue, you realize, oh, faith better be something different than belief, or I'm basically alone in the universe with my beliefs.
Yeah.
That's all I've got to count on.
Yeah.
Which can be a pretty significant crisis of both belief and faith. For lots of people, so that can be a hard corner to turn. For most of us in this room, Matthew, the Christian tradition has been important part of our story, as it has for you. We may not have been ideal Christian young people, but we tried, and or not, or we just gave it up, right? We'll talk another day about a wonderful book that I've read called How to Be a Bad Christian, which is a lovely book. Anyway, when we come from that, Matthew, as you did, and we come from, many of us also, from that realm where the idea that there might be something beyond right belief as a way of knowing and experiencing, if we get kind of past that, oh no, this is fearful part, is there an intersection between these practices and that same stream of tradition, the history of Christianity, if you want to use kind of a phrase that immediately suggests we're in for something boring?
Yeah. Yeah.
What are some of the linkages that you've run across that have been meaningful to you?
Yeah, I think for me, there was a process of feeling the limitations of my understanding, there was a sense that, well, there's got to be something more to this. And coming from this a place of kind of existential angst and uncertainty, and really struggling with, well, what is this Christianity all about? You know, what is this, you know, peace and joy that I'm supposed to, I feel like I should be experiencing, but don't feel like I really understand or have much access to. And for a while, you know, moving beyond the limitations of my beliefs, there was still a sense of, okay, maybe the issue is I'm just believing the wrong things.
So you're still after right belief.
Yeah,
at
exactly.
That point in the process,
so right? I just started reading and devouring whatever I could that offered some kind of foothold, handhold to something better. And I thought, well, I just need to get it right. And if I can figure it out, you know, this is the answer. And I even started reading Henry Nouwen and books about the inner life, and that I'd never really encountered before. And that became something that was still like, oh, if I can just figure this out, then whatever that looks like, then that must be the answer. There must be something of some sense of understanding, seeing things the right way, speaking about things the right way, believing things the right way. And then at a certain point, it just became very clear that was not a dead end, but it wasn't really going to take me all the way. And within my experience, I didn't really realize that at the time. I just didn't have a sense of the mystical dimension within the Christian tradition, which has been there from the beginning. And you know, however we that's defined, I would just define it as more this the pursuit of an experiential knowledge of God. That's not an intellectual knowledge, but a deep a deep communion. And that there's this whole other dimension of the spiritual path that really places more of an emphasis on that.
Just a little pause there, Matthew. Would you be willing to speculate, and I let's treat it as speculation in this conversation, as to why it is that that part of the Christian tradition seems to have been rendered so, if not invisible, hard to find or see in contemporary Christian practice? Like, it's there. It's not, when you start looking for it, it's not very hard to find.
Right. Yeah.
Why has it been put to the side so aggressively, I would say?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's probably so many different reasons. I think one of them, you know, even in terms of the formation of Christianity as like a coherent tradition and path, it makes sense that there was this need of figuring out, well, what's kind of the thing that's holding us together? And so we need to figure out, you know, when you're under persecution, it becomes important to know what hill you're literally willing to die on. And I can understand why there's, you know, at least in moments where it's like, oh, we need to know what the right things to believe are. And I don't know that the experiential dimension was ever totally denigrated, but it was like, well, that needs to take a back seat, because we need to figure out how we're going to be together and how we want to cohere these things. And then another dimension is probably the fact that you don't get to control that. You know, you can control your beliefs, you can control, and not even in necessarily a way of like, well, controlling other people, but even the sense of feeling like you have control over your own life, having control over your understanding, when you feel like that's solid, it's more comfortable. And it's you know, one of the things that I've encountered and continue to encounter and seems that it's never going to change is that this deeper experiential dimension of encountering God always is a place of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. It's always in a place of where I don't have control over what happens.
And in fact, one could make, this is an oversimplification, I know, but one could make the argument that we go into practices like meditation or mindfulness or silence of any thorough, deliberate description, mm-hmm. so that we will shut up.
Yeah.
Like we're doing this so we will be quiet and listen. So we actually don't speak in silence. That sounds terribly obvious, doesn't it? We were speaking, it wouldn't be silence. But I don't know how many of you would think about your own spiritual practice growing up. How many of you grew up, and you can put up your hand for this one, I don't think it's incriminating. How many of you grew up with the idea of doing your devotions? Yeah, okay. What an odd English phrase. Devoted being something we are. Doing your devotions. But this is the practice of spending time with God, right? But what do you do when you do your devotions? Well, you take all kinds of resources with you. You take your Bible. You take your favorite music. You take your journal. Not bad things. They do not equal silence. They're all ways of speech.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's quiet time, sort of conscious quiet time with God. Yeah, I know you didn't grow up in that tradition, Ariel, so I'm aware of that in this room, but I was curious to see. I mean, you saw the hands, right? Yeah, who didn't? Anyone, has Ariel got any company? Yes, okay, awesome, right. And there, I can think of a couple of other folks in the community whose hands would be up if they were here. So you're not all alone. Ariel, it's an odd, not unhelpful, but an odd idea to try to bring to the idea of spiritual practice, especially silence, because it's not silence. It's telling God how God should be.
Right.
Right? The same thing we do when we sing most often. We're actually saying, this is my idea about God. But we often say those things in ways that are like speaking to God and saying, you're like this.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't take the time in those settings to put the bracket in front that says, I think of you like this. Which would dial them into a completely different space.
Mm.
Then there are notions about God, not the last word on the divine.
Yeah.
When we become silent, what we're doing is inviting the divine to have the last word on the divine.
Mm.
And that you have to let go of the control that comes with all those forms of speech to do that.
Yeah.
Right? Different way of sort of describing the same thing.
Yeah.
Take us sort of from that idea, which I think is so central, that in silence, in meditation, in mindfulness, all these different things, I think particularly in, we didn't take a lot of time to differentiate between meditation and mindfulness, but particularly in silence and meditation, where we stop making noise, including idea noise.
Right.
Right. Can you kind of connect that openness and vulnerability to all the chatter in our lives and in our minds and in our spirits?
So one of the things when I first began exploring meditation, I encountered this far outside of the Christian tradition because I didn't really know how to access it there. And it just happened to be in India talking to a Jewish Buddhist monk. And that's kind of cool. But I was just really curious about meditation because he was telling me about he had been a monk in a Zen monastery for 3 years. And meditating, you know, 10 hours a day. And I was like, well, what is this about? I'm really curious. And so he asked me what I thought it was. And I said, like, well, I don't know. You just kind of, like, quiet your mind, I guess. I don't know. It seems pretty difficult. And he's like, oh, well, where do you get that idea from? I said, I have no idea. That's just the sense that I got. And actually, you know, my experience of practice is it really hasn't been about that at all. Which, in fact, makes it much more, I think, relevant to the lives that we're living, because there just really aren't that many opportunities to turn everything off. And I don't know that we would necessarily even want to do that if we could. But what is the quality of presence that we have in the midst of the chatter? You know, where is God? God isn't in the places where we have to shut everything off, because God is in the midst of it all. And so part of it's a shift of focus and a shift of attention and orientation, and the discovery that, oh, I don't have to, not only do I not have to say the right words or do the right practices in order for God to be present, but God is already present in the midst of whatever nonsense is going on, you know, in my mental experience, in my emotions, in whatever's happening around me. And that I think for me has been the most, you know, in terms of belief, I don't think we can ever escape our beliefs and our ideas of what's real and how the world is and who we are.
We kind of need those at some
point.
Right? They're the handles that we grab to work
right,
with
things
in the world.
Exactly. So it's not a sense of one of the things that's transformed for me, or is transforming, continues to be transformed, is the sense of how do I relate to and work with and hold these ideas that are not me, but they're still valuable, and being able to see that learning to be able to just be comfortable in the midst of you know, potentially a lot of inner discomfort, whatever I might be experiencing, there's a capacity to be able to hold more in life, in the world, in the complexity that we encounter, in the difficult experiences, to be able to show up in a way where we're not holding on so tightly to how we want things to be, but are becoming more and more open to just approaching things as they are.
So what do we do what do we do with the beliefs? I mean, the beliefs that we hold didn't typically just parachute out of the sky onto us.
Right.
Right. We've grown up with them in different ways, or we've engaged with them in different ways over time, and they've become woven into us.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to even tease them out without a fair bit of work sometimes. We
have
to stand quite a ways back from ourselves before we can go, oh, I believe this. This belief is distinct from me.
Yeah.
I share it with other people. It's a thing.
Yeah.
And not just gravity.
Yeah.
Right? Or spiritual gravity or personal gravity. When we have that crisis of belief, when we're kind of wrestling with, we become conscious of a belief that we hold and its limitations, however we've had that experience. And we've talked about lots of different ways in this community that we have that experience where we kind of come, we feel like we come to the end of an idea, right? Here's an idea. It's really important to me. The world's supposed to work like this according to this idea. And then we have a lived experience where it's like, oh my God, the world doesn't work like that. Now what do I do? Because that was a foundational idea or belief.
Yeah.
Could you, when we talked before, you had a kind of a neat metaphor, I think a really accessible environmental metaphor for what the experience of that is like, where you talked about our beliefs kind of being something that grow and how we can deal with their growth.
Mm. Yeah. So that was a good metaphor. I wish I remember more.
I have it in my notes.
Yeah, yeah.
You talked about paving them over.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So when when you think of what you believe, when I think of what I believe, it sometimes feels like I'm in control of that. And when I really, when you really parse it apart, it's like, I don't actually know where all of these things start from. They're just kind of emerging in my experience. And there's a sense of, we want some kind of stability. I want some kind of stability. There's that's like a human proclivity that we have. We want something secure. And so there's a sense of our beliefs grow and shift and adapt to new experiences, to new relationships, to when we encounter the limitations of the way that we currently understand things, there's a sense of, oh, there's a movement that's happening. And that can be, disorienting and frustrating, and it opens up the space of not knowing that is actually has so much potential. I mean, that's where I feel like, when you talk about the potential of change in ourselves or change in the world, it's that edge of where we don't quite know what's possible, where we don't quite know what's beyond the limitations of what we know, and it's tempting to want to just pave over that and be like, nope, we just have to keep it here, and this feels secure, but inevitably, and I think that can work at times, but there are situations that we encounter that can be so dramatic, they just kind of force their way through and something bursts through the pavement. When you see the grass kind of coming through the asphalt, it's like, that doesn't seem like it has a lot of power to be able to do that, but there's so much force of this kind of life, this sense of wanting to engage in the world in a way that makes sense to us. Our understandings just kind of shift and have to find a way through. And when we're kind of so firm and fixed in our ideas, and that can even be in the sense that, well, nothing's true and none of this matters, it's easy to move from, that's not a different approach from, what I used to believe was wrong. It's the same approach, it's just you've just kind of moved the pieces around.
Yeah.
And now what I believe, which is none of that was true, but this is really true this time.
Right.
And this is the solid foundation.
It can sound like philosophical gobbledygook, but it's actually a practice to believe that nothing is believable.
Yeah.
Or nothing is ultimate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's not so much the particulars of the belief, but what kind of, in what way are we holding those, and how are we holding those down? And that can be, when we are, that can be a traumatic experience. And one of the gifts of contemplative practice in whatever forms is this recognition, like you were saying, our beliefs are not us. you know, our beliefs are not, our beliefs about ourselves are not who we are. Our beliefs about God is not who God is. That can be helpful, and it is helpful language at times and ways of relating to others and the world. And yet, there's more. There's always more. There's a mystery to ourselves, let alone God. There's a mystery to relationship, what happens between us that you can't fully capture in words. And yet that's always this perpetual temptation. We want to be able to capture it in words and be able to have some sense of control. And I think that's one of the more, for me it's both incredibly compelling and also at times terrifying to be able to say, wow, I don't actually know. I don't know in any kind of solid sense what's happening, what's right, who God is, who I am. And yet at the same time, there's also an ease with that, that the more time I spend in that space of not knowing and just being open. And one way that I've grown to talk about meditation, the way that I approach it, is it's just a practice of trust and surrender. You know, and that's what continues to draw me within the Christian tradition as well. That I never really felt like I left it, but I had to go in other directions in order to discover some of these practices, and I don't know, returning maybe isn't the right word, but recognizing in a different way so much of my experience within the Christian story and the person of Jesus. Looking at it now is like, oh, it's this. I see it now as just this deep call for letting go and trusting in God, whatever God is, whatever even language we want to use. But there's something there. There's something worth trusting, and it's not about having the right beliefs. Those aren't the things worth trusting and giving our lives to. It's what's on the other side of that.
Which is why the mystics end up using language like trusting that which is, trusting the great peace and so on, the embracing generous language, not as an attempt to love something so amorphous that a word like love becomes meaningless, but because we are engaging with more than we can know by just believing.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And so we kind of come to the limitations of belief.
Yeah.
Speaking of limitations, we need to wrap this up because of expectations about time and our own ways we live with that. Mm. And we have some songs we would like to sing together as well. So we're going to do that. If you need to go, of course, as is always the case at the table, do what you need to do and know that nobody's looking askance at you. But one thing I just want to mention to folks before we wrap this up, Matthew. Like lots of conversations at the table, this is a conversation starter, not a conversation finisher. This is not about the tidy conclusion where we all go away going, oh, now I know what I should believe about meditation and mindfulness. That was really helpful. More just an opening into something enormous.
Absolutely.
Right? We can practice these things on our own. We can practice them together with others. Those are different experiences, and they open in different ways. Mm-hmm. I know that you're contemplating and talking with some folks about the idea of starting a group.
Yeah.
Engage with some of this. Can I just point people to you for that conversation at this point?
Yep.
And just say, please, if you're interested in that or you're interested in any of the ideas that we've sort of touched on or just gestured toward in this conversation, talk to Matthew and see what comes of it.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, and just one to say something about that. So one of the things for me is that meditation, these contemplative practices, yeah, they seem so separate and individual, and yet engaging with other people continues to be more and more compelling to me. And so one of the things I'm starting beginning next month, and it'll run for a couple months, is a small group for those of you who are familiar, but with a different approach where we'll be exploring some contemplative practice, but also this question of, oh, how do we be together in a way that makes room for the differences in our understanding and really is able to create space for our unique experience of Christ and Christianity in a way that allows us to embrace that together. And so there's more particulars related to that. But it's certainly an open invitation if anyone here would be interested in something like that, doing a small group in a way that's maybe different than you've experienced small groups before. Talk to myself or Tim and we can connect.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Matthew, thank you.